In order to approach the Old Testament as a compound, we know that for Christian people, the Old Testament forms a background or a frame for the messianic revelation to which Christendom is particularly addicted religiously. This is entirely a different viewpoint from that of the Orthodox Jew, who does not regard the Old Testament as really a complementary Bible or work. He is willing to admit that particularly the prophetic books of the Old Testament do contain intimations or announcements of the coming of a Messiah. Christian theologians have assumed, rather dogmatically, that these intimations and implications refer to the advent of Jesus. Here, of course, is one of the major points of difference between Judaism and Christianity. This attitude is not acceptable in general to the Orthodox Jewish scholar. He points out many elements of the Old Testament account which would sustain his position that the New Testament is not a fulfillment of the Old. But the two books have been brought together for other purposes, or at least have achieved a different purpose. In survey, we must remember that the New Testament, as it stands, is essentially a moral historical document. It deals with the life of Jesus of Nazareth and, to a degree, of the lives of his immediate disciples and apostles. It passes into the Pauline epistles and gradually develops a related field of literature. It is a powerful moral work. It is a tremendous statement of mystical faith. And it is a strong and definite revelation of religious ethics. If the New Testament is deficient in one particular, when compared with most of the sacred books of the world, it is deficient in cosmology. It is deficient in anthropology. In other words, it does not carry into its own substance any essential description or explanation. For this reason, the Old Testament forms an appropriate background. It answers certain questions concerning the race and the nation from which Jesus came, the beliefs of this race, the unfoldment of their religious and political psychology, the rise and fall of their national existence. And furthermore, it gives us a broad picture of the psychological structure of the Jewish people of that time and of their religious problems and of their general attitude towards the essentials of spiritual life. But it should be included seems to be more than justified for the words of Jesus himself when he proclaimed definitely that he came not to destroy the prophets but to fulfill them. And in order that the position of the prophet whom he came to fulfill might be understandable, it was almost inevitably necessary to link the Old Testament and the New. The Old Testament was not written originally in the same language as the New Testament. The linguistic difficulties in the older Chaldaic Hebrew are far more ponderous and numerous than those of Greek. Up to the present time, no really ancient manuscript of the Old Testament in the Jewish writings is known. Nearly all of the so-called scrolls and Pentateuchs, now to be found in synagogues, are translations and retranslations from the Greek. The oldest manuscripts of the Old Testament are to be found in the great Greek manuscripts of the Bible, the Sinaiticus and the Vatican. These manuscripts, dating from about the 3rd century, are the oldest comprehensive group we have. There are earlier fragments, but they do not give us too large or full an understanding.
Thus we know that we are confronted with serious problems of language. And we must gradually recover from our popular belief that the Bible was written in the King's English at the request of King James I of England. It was not. This is an exaggeration. The Old Testament was probably revised or codified sometime about the 5th century B.C. There is a strong record, or tradition at least, not on the table, let us point that out, but still rather strongly extended, that the earlier writings were almost completely destroyed, and that during the time of Ezra, a group of scholars forming a rabbinical college, working together, perhaps under the leadership of one or two of the older patriarchs, rewrote or revised and brought into an integrated form the earlier and lost manuscript of the Jewish book. Now, this may or may not be a defensible attitude or belief, but it is certainly traditional and has been in existence for a long time. Nor is it essentially unreasonable, for it is quite possible that a religious literature in Palestine, 1,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era, was highly respectable. In those days, manuscripts were very few, and copying was an exceedingly difficult undertaking. Therefore, it is quite possible that not many manuscripts of the Torah, or of the prophetic books, or of the literary works, were available. These could either have been lost, or so hopelessly misplaced, that they were not available. This point, of course, is also strengthened by the fact that they have never discovered any of them. And therefore, they could not have been especially numerous. We have many, many copies of Egyptian manuscripts going back as far as 3,000 or 3,500 B.C. But we have no such available manuscripts relating to the Old Testament. Thus, it is quite possible that the literature was exceedingly limited in amount and perished, or nearly perished, from the numerous vicissitudes that took place in the past of Israel. So much for its basic historical orientation in the limited time that we have. The second point for consideration is the authorship of the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch is generally referred to as the five books of Moses. We have, however, no absolute proof that Moses was their author. Nor do we gain such an evidence or proof from the reading of the books themselves. Most of the writing is in the third person. This, however, is not again concluded because of the grammatical form used at that time. We do not, however, have the internal or sustaining traditional evidence to prove that Moses was the actual author of these books. He is the traditionally accepted author. It is not impossible that he did write that. This is one of the religious but uncertainties which is as yet unsolvable. There are some groups composed of rather adequate scholars are inclined to favor the belief that Moses did write these books. There are others who feel definitely that he probably did not. Then there is a third group occupying a sort of more or less middle ground that point out that according to the custom and the propriety of the time, Moses undoubtedly would have made use of scribes. In other words, he probably would not have written the book through his own hand. He would have used professional writers or secretaries. And that these may have changed from time to time, and thus we would have certain editorial differences, different methods of presenting material. This is quite possible. Also, we know beyond any reasonable doubt that although he might attribute the authorship of the Pentateuch to Moses, that there are fragments, sections, and parts of it that are almost certainly derived from older sources. Some of these sources may have been Egyptian. Some of them may have been oral traditions of surrounding tribes and groups. But frequently, in the unfoldment of the Mosaic writings, we find interludes or interpolations which can definitely be traced to other sources. These include a considerable part of the opening of Genesis. And the Chaldean Gables, now in the British Museum, is translated by Professor Piazza's Quest, indicates a considerable part of Genesis' story was derived from the Chaldean cuneiform, a much older tradition, going back long before even the so-called Hebraic date of creation. Thus, we can find the probability of several authors, or we can find several layers or levels of writing representing extracts from different periods. We must also face the inevitable that there are interpolations of a later date that could not possibly have been written by Moses. Whether these interpolations were originally glosses and were gradually incorporated into the text, we do not know. But we do know that this particular occurrence has taken place in the Christian writings, and a number of codices of as late as the 8th century indicate that scribes made marginalia, or notes on the edges, and later scribes incorporated these notes into the text, so that we have a story arising from this gradual loss of lines of demarcation between original material and interpolated or interpreted material of a more recent date. The Jewish religious tradition is a much more complicated one than we are first inclined to assume. These people, as you can well imagine, being an ancient and oriental nation, developed immense and incredible religious facility. They were never content merely to accept the letters and forms and shapes of things. They always sought for something deeper, something more important. And in the development of their sacred writings, they appear to have incorporated many mysterious kabbals or ciphers into the text of their work. These ciphers originated at least in part from their concept of language. Originally, the old Hebraic, or Chaldean Hebraic language, was rather more limited than it is today. There was probably a time when the complete alphabet did not consist of more than about 10 or 12 letters. It is sometimes assumed that there were originally 7 consonants and 5 and 3 vowels. This may not be entirely correct, but it does indicate that as we retire further into the background of language, we are inclined to note the increasing signs of deficiency of available words and terms. This particular problem does present itself to Bible students. We are not at all sure of all of the grammatical constructions of the old Jewish and rabbinical teachers. The same problem confronts us with the Egyptian hieroglyphs. Since the work of Sophonius and the discovery of the Rosetta Stone, we can translate such Egyptian manuscripts as the Books of the Dead and other surviving fragments, descriptions, dates, mortuary offerings, things of that nature, prayers. But we are not at all sure that we are exhausting the potential of the language. Dr. Preston, the University of Chicago, told me in his work in connection with Egyptian manuscripts that he was quite certain that many of the word signs and glyphs had double meaning, and that we have simply lost the knowledge of the better and deeper meaning. This would be definitely true in connection with the old Jewish language. Jewish scholars themselves know definitely that there are meanings to these words and to the combinations of them, with which we are no longer familiar. Therefore, that we can read the surface, but we cannot penetrate to the subsurfaces of the ideas and mental processes of the time. This could and does lead to a great deal of danger and error. But where we have not the psychic sympathy with the original, we cannot any longer relive the idiom of the article. We are at a very serious disadvantage. Even today, the American people do not use their language correctly. And if a scholar does use it correctly, he is likely to be misunderstood. And this follows all the time and habit patterns. Words change their meaning. words increase in importance and decrease, and structured in the same way. The beginning of the study of the Old Testament, then, should naturally and reasonably begin with a careful study of the philosophy of Hebraic writing. Without some knowledge of this particular field, there is always going to be a very difficult situation at hand. The writing is not always on the surface. The writing is definitely subsurface. We know, for example, that due to certain religious conditions, the old texts are left without vowel points, and without vowels. And the later development of diacritical from Mark does not indicate any sure knowledge of where they belong or how they should originally have been used. Thus, we have only traditional forms, and even these change from time to time. The Hebrew writings, or the Chaldean Hebrew records, have a common origin, and it is rather important to give a little thought to that as we go by. I'm not going to step down that far. French letter, the Hebrew alphabet, is a tiny little mark that resembles a comma. It is called a yod. It was made like that. Now this letter actually, as far as we can learn, means a plane. In other words, the entire alphabet is composed of combinations of planes. Now in this we begin to find, for example, something that I have often believed in wrong perspective, namely, that the Hebrew scriptures are very largely books interpreting the basic concept of Jewish philosophy, which is in the letters themselves, and not in the writings which are composed of these letters. Now, the original letter is susceptible of appearing in numerous patterns and forms. We can take one of these yods in this way. We can add another yod to it and another yod to it. We have the Hebrew letter A. And this is really composed of three planes. Now, what does the letter A itself mean in Hebrew? It means fire. Therefore, it is the beginning of the alphabet. It is a restatement of the strange belief of these people in the association of letters and fire. James Gattaro, who was the astronomer and scholar extraordinary, to Cardinal Richelieu, believe that these plane points and the original structures of the letters were derived from the constellations. In other words, that these little planes represented stars. And in certain early forms of Hebrew writing, we still find them represented as star forms. These then constituted the original of the handwriting on the wall of heaven. Now, if we consider the fixed stars and their groupings, the forms of consonantal letters of the Hebrew language, then we are not very far off either when we suspect that the planets moving in the orbits of the constellations became the vowels. And as these vowels constantly change their relation to the consonants, it is conceivable that an endless group of words can be formed. And that these words change because of the motion of the vowels through the consonantal form. This is a very old Greek, by the way, and perhaps is of some interest to us. Now, in the early Pentateuchal writings, we have the Aaronistic form of the name of God, which is also very important to us at this particular stage in our study, because the name of God is written in this form, the yod and the final end. Part of it is written from left to right and consists of A-L-H-I-M. We generally pronounce that as Elohim, or more perhaps correctly, Elohim. Now it was
is the Elohim.
Then in Genesis, moved upon the face of the deep. Because up to that time, the other God form which was to finally take its place, and which was to then continue throughout the entire trial. These, of course, if they're complete and drawn, are also all plain. I'm just not taking the time to draw them completely. This form, of course, is the IHVH, which we translate Jehovah, or God, but which the Orthodox Jew in the old days never pronounced at all. Whenever he came to this name, he used another name or another word in order that the name of deity might not be spoken or profaned in another in any way. He was therefore most apt to say Adonai, or Lord, because he was not inclined to use this sacred form so freely. Now let us, for example, change this pattern for a moment, and let us begin here. And a rewrite, I'm going to do it rather, you know, quickly, because I don't want to take you time. The name Elohim. Then we place here, for our purposes, we have five letters. And against these five letters, we can, for your own convenience, if you wish to do so, write the words Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Now, it may not at first appear particularly sensible, but let us remember that the revelation of the Pentateuch is actually contained within the name Elohim and becomes the basic key to it. And by the use of the name, we also gain a knowledge of what is meant by the various books of the Pentateuch. Therefore, the beginning of the Pentateuch is represented by the fire letter A. The second part of the Pentateuch, which is what is called the historical and religious unfoldment, is under the Lamed, or L. The next part, which is the revelation of the Levitical law, is under the H. Genesis, Leviticus, Numbers. Numbers is peculiarly and serenely important, because in the book of Numbers is concealed by the text itself the significance of the letter Yod, because in this, the letter Yod, being the most primary and complete and perfect symbol of God, it is in this book that the revelation to Moses on Sinai is contained. The last word, which is the recapitulation and contains the three great discourses of Moses on the establishment of the law, is under the final end. And if you study the words very carefully, you will realize that they do actually unfold the power of the Elohim or the Creator. The five powers of these creators being represented through the unfolding of the books themselves. Now, this is, I won't be going to do this much for a moment because we can't take the time with our problem to go into it. But this is the way it would be approached by the old scholars of Pentateuch. They would begin to speak for the original meaning, tying the languages to the basic concept involved. In other words, every part of it contains mathematical formulas. Each of the Hebrew letters is a number. The numbers add up. They can be divided. They can be progressed for the same general concept that we find in the Pythagorean system of the Greeks, and which later occurs in the Gnostic keys a numerical piece in the New Testament. All of these elements are part of one strange and peculiar and remarkable story. Perhaps the most important thing that they teach us immediately is to convey the inclination to go further, to realize that we do not exhaust the potential for this situation by memorizing merely the biblical stories themselves. Now, as we have only a certain amount of time, I'd like to more or less check over with you, in brief, the plan, the scheme that unfolds through the pages. These books are not merely separate writings. They are the integrated parts of one story. They consist of a prologue, Genesis, and an epilogue, Deuteronomy. And between these two are placed the remaining three books, in their order, and in a sequence which is acceptable not only to the historian, but to the psychologist and the sociologist. Concealed within the elaborate oriental process, with its rich emphasis upon genealogies and the defense of family, and its heavy concern with the wanderings of the tribes and their wars, and the various edicts and the various revelations that were given, the story unfolds essentially in a simple way. The purpose of Genesis is not primarily to present the story of creation, for it is limited to only a very few chapters. The true purpose of Genesis is to establish the integrity of the Pentateuchal dispensation. Its purpose is to remind the reader and the student of the setting aside of a chosen people, a people peculiarly and wonderfully provided for and protected, that through them and through their works and through their labors, a dispensational law might be revealed. The entire emphasis in the Pentateuch is upon the unfoldment of this dispensational law. Now, it is not by any means the theme which exhausts the wealth of the symbolism of these books, but it is the great thread that runs through the five themes. The first book, therefore, deals primarily with the answer to the question, why the dispensation, or the question, how it came about. And in this we see the gradual representation of a selectivity on the part of the creating power. Now this selectivity is perfectly traditional religiously. It is to be found wherever sacred books are found. In every system of sacred books belonging to an ancient people or a race, the integration shows the emphasis upon that racial culture. In other words, the race is claiming itself and is telling the story of its own psychic entity or its own psychic existence. It is telling us the deepest motivations which it can comprehend for its own creation and perpetuation. Thus, in the works in the book of Genesis, we also have a moral or spiritual situation established by means of which the rest of the Pentateuch becomes inevitably necessary. In other words, wherever we develop a concept, we must create a pattern. And the concept becomes the basis of the precept, or that which naturally and inevitably follows it. Thus, the kind of a dispensation, the rules and laws of its maintenance and its development, and the need for all of the various ramifications that later arise must be established in the basic premise. And in Genesis, we have the basic premise, not only of the Mosaic tradition, but to a very large degree of the Christian doctrine which followed after. In the opening chapters of Genesis, therefore, we are presented with a story of a divine creation, disobedience, and a fall.
In other words, we find the individual establishing an interval between himself and God. An interval which must be crossed by repentance, by a life of virtue, by obedience to law, and by the gradual integration of the concept of a moral and religious life. Had the fall not been in the opening chapters of Genesis, there would have been no need for Leviticus or Deuteronomy or Numbers. There would have been no need for a messianic redeemer unless there had been original sin. So in the year of Pentateuch, we find the primary symbolic statement of man's need. We find the tremendous spiritual necessity by which all of the rest of the work, in fact, all the moral cultures of religion, are deemed to depend. Now, in this particular instance, we have a situation in which disobedience causes the departure of man from the paradisical state and forces him to take upon himself the burden of original sin. We find, therefore, that he is exiled from his native land, so from his proper spiritual abode. He is exiled also from the conscious power to apprehend the presence of God. And after he has been expelled from the garden, he no longer is able to know the Lord who walks in the garden in the cool of the evening. He is deprived, therefore, of the direct and immediate knowledge of God. Now, this particular concept, of course, is not original in Jewish literature. It belongs to a great religious tradition which has existed since time immemorial. But it is the springboard or the foundation of the life of repentance. It is the concept which lies behind man's search for a lost truth, a lost word, a lost reality, a hidden God. Thus the Pentateuch must establish this, which it does in the opening chapters of Genesis. In these opening chapters, there is a brief summary of what it seems to me is the Sumerian account of the Genesis. In other words, this story is based upon the traditions, lore, and legendary of the Sumerian people and of the Akkad and of other peoples inhabiting the ancient area of the Valley of the Euphrates. This creation itself, with its customary division, this creation can be given a very great deal of consideration. We can only touch upon one or two of the more essential elements of it. We find, for example, that in this creation concept, we are first presented with the concept of the Elohim. Now, in any sort of Jewish language or Jewish tradition, realize this term, Elohim, representing creator power, is an androgynous plural word. The end termination means that equivalent to our end. Therefore, the Elohim cannot be regarded as a monotheistic deity. They can only be accepted, as they were in Egypt and in Syria and in other lands, as Ammonian artifices, a group of creating powers. And in this, we also find the revival later, and which has often been assumed to be an empiric form, but which does not necessarily follow from the Jewish writing. Namely, and God said, let us make man in our image. It seems again to suggest a reference back to the Elohim form, although by that time we are beginning to find the Yahvistic or monotheistic deity taking over in the text. Thus we observe, as we proceed, that the same word is not used for God in all parts of the Bible. But this term changes. The reason for this change, I think we will be able to understand as we proceed. There have been many questions as to where the story of Adam and Eve came from. Again, I don't think we can dogmatize, but research seems to indicate that most of these stories, such as the Osirian legend in Egypt, and, of course, the Dionysian cycle in Greece, and certain of the Brahmanic cycles in Far Asia all originated from religious drama or play. That in all probability, at a remote time, these stories were actually enacted, and the candidates seeking initiation into their tribal rights, much as the American Indians of our own Southwest today, pass through initiatory rituals in which religious incidents are dramatized. There is much to indicate from the form and construction that the original story of the fall of man was at some time in a remote past part of the religious pageantry of a great philosophical religious system, and that gradually the story was transformed into an account where it at one time had been witnessed or beheld as an actual dramatic action. The story itself deals undoubtedly with certain factors which have been universally revered by mankind since the beginning of time. The study of the name Adam, like the study of the name Eve, also tells us that we are not primarily dealing with people. We are dealing with collectives, or we are dealing with qualities of life and consciousness. We are not dealing with a physical, biological story. And this is one of the solutions which will ultimately prove very valuable to us. Because when we begin to recognize the philosophical intent of the matter and the symbolism used, we are no longer in conflict with physical anthropology. We are no longer in conflict with science. Because our problem belongs on an entirely different level. Therefore, it does not necessarily mean that to believe in the Bible, you must disbelieve in the glacial period and in the vast antiquity of man. We are dealing actually with a problem in physical phenomena, or a problem of internal experience, and not necessarily merely with something that might have happened in the world 4,000 or 5,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era. With recognizing this remedy as being very important to us, we can begin to understand, again, certain of the uses of the terms and signs and symbols which we find in the old Jewish law. And so we would have a great deal of interesting and adventurous time with these problems. I want to take the second of the sacred names that we referred to, and that we will again also put now in a vertical form. You have to be very careful not to connect this letter here. If you connect, it becomes a different letter. But now we have the four letters in the name of Jehovah, or Yahweh, or the Lord, placed in a vertical position. The moment they are placed in that position, we see that they form the human body. It's very obvious. Now, there's an interesting statement in the Bible that the man is the head of the woman. Have you ever looked up that? It's a very familiar statement. All right. And that can cause a lot of trouble in one day. We don't believe that anymore. But here I would say that we go back to the old rabbinical law and we take the head away. What do we have left in Hebrew? We have H, D, H, or E, D, E. Therefore, we have, a strange problem. If we take away the head, we have the woman left. We have a very deep and wonderful mystery contained within this story. In the ancient methods of study and writing and so on, the use of these Kabbalah forms are tremendously stimulating and interesting. Because actually, the name of deity is composed of four parts, represented by the four letters, which in turn represent the power of God in the four worlds. This includes, of course, Asiya, Yetzira, and Briah, and the other parts of the ancient great universe. The symbol of Eve became, in the ancient Hebrew, the symbol of the world soul, or the psychic nature of man. And of course, it is in this context that we find the division used in the Bible. In the great commentaries on Genesis, found in old Jewish writings, we find, according to the story, that Adam was created androgynous. That he consisted of two bodies back to back. And the so-called creative act consisted of the separating of these two bodies, each of which faced a different way. And according to the old Mosaic tradition, have always faced a different way ever since. Against these two, each facing a different way, traveling as far as they can apart, they will ultimately meet. Because they must inevitably travel in the great circle of that to have absolute, or the tremendous cycle of time. So that the further they apart they get, the nearer they come together, which the old scholars knew in a very ancient time. They realized, as Einstein later demonstrated, the curvature of the continuum, and that anything continuing forever in a straight line will form a circle. So in the Old Testament, and in all these writings, Eve, the mother of the living, and the great symbol of the creative psychic power of deity, was an essential attribute of deity, which was transferred in the formation of male and female from the universe to man himself. So that in a mysterious way, deity was divided to form man. And the reformation, or the union of man as male and female, restored deity. It has been beginning to run into water, but the philosophy of each step of this is deep, and leads us almost inevitably to realize that the Bible is a very wonderful work if we can understand it. Now, in the beginning, according to Genesis, the spirits of Elohim moved upon the face of the deep. That is, a tremendous creative power moved in the form of the fiery whirlwind. In the Greeks, it is said, universal creation was the result of the striving of ether and chaos. And in the East Indian philosophies, we have the same concept, the formation of the great egg of the Aranyagarbha, which was formed out of the whirlings of space. And the striving, or as it was called, the labors or bearings of space, resulted gradually in the emergence of a conditioned existence out of an unconditioned existence. This is far better in the actual Jewish than the translation that we have in English. For much nearer to the meaning it would be in the first chapter of Genesis. Out of the everlasting, we say in the beginning. But more correctly, it would be out of the everlasting. The male-female creating powers fashioned or caused to emerge or generated of themselves the substances of the superior and the inferior creation. In other words, they brought forth two things, like the gold and silver hemispheres of the great age of things in the East. They brought forth differentiation in the Pythagorean, the one telling the two, that become the basis of diversity. So in the beginning, an unconditioned, that eternal state was divided into conditions. And in this condition which first existed, there was that which was inner and that which was outer, that which was superior and that which was inferior, that which was above and that which was below, all in terms of quality, not in terms of location. And out of these two polarized principles, called ether and chaos for the Greeks, there were fashions, or caused to come forth, the mysterious principle of creation itself. Creation, in order to exist by the rabbinical code of the old law, must first become unbalanced. Space must unbalance itself, creating a superior and inferior, an abundance and a privation, abyss and habit. And out of these imbalances, the great motion toward equilibrium began. And creation is the motion toward equilibrium. Thus we have in the Safar of Zohar, the books of the splendors, the old statement that unbalanced forces perish in the void. Thus passed the giants and the kings of Edom of ancient times. Unbalanced is in itself inevitably destructive. Therefore, the moment it comes into existence, every resource of the universe moves toward equilibrium. The unbalance cannot be permitted to continue. And yet, unbalance is the dynamic. Unbalance is therefore original sin. Because it is the only thing in the universe that requires and demands and must have immediate correction. Therefore, the moment unbalance exists, every potential of nature moves towards the restoration of equilibrium or the restoring of harmony. So in the beginning, the mysterious scales, which we find in the Egyptian mystery, tipped. And in the tipping of the scales, objectivity was created. This tipping of the scales was the loss of totality, the breaking up of complete integration or wholeness, and the establishment of relatives in the place of that of the absolute. The moment these relatives were engendered, the moment relationships existed, they, in the words of the Greeks, they hasten toward each other to form again reintegration or reorganization. In the Hebrew tradition, it is thought that these two opposites, having become what we would term spirit and matter, or life and the absence of life, or relative absence of life, because even these old physicists were well aware of the fact that there is no total absence anywhere in nature. These lives, moving together, found them in a great cycle of existence, that they had built around themselves, coats of skin, bodies, forms. The Hebrew word is almost the same as the Greek, and that is chiton, meaning a coat or a garment. And these coats of skin, personality, inhibit the reunion of divided parts. Therefore, things seem to me, but they do not, because the life within them is prevented from mingling, because of the external instruments which have been created through time and existence. Thus, the motion toward identity is frustrated by the instruments which these divided parts have fashioned for themselves. Thus, we have minds and emotions and bodies and instincts and attitudes and appetites. And by these, we are divided. And by the unified life within us is unable to be restored into its original pattern and form. Thus the answer became the second part of our great problem. We follow through in the story of Genesis, and we observe the gradual intensification of the conflict between reality and unreality. The conflict that has to exist, or reality itself, is without substantiation or without truth. It is only, therefore, through the experience of illusion that man is capable of the apperception of reality. Good example of this is Carl Sagan. Here we find the individual, or man, attempting to break through or to pierce into the mysteries of heaven. We find him creating a great ziggurat, or tower, from the earth, which is to reach up to the gods. We find this end only in a confusion of tongues, which is an internal reminder of man that the things which he builds with bricks of mud without straw. Thus, the entire story of man's attempt to physically conquer the mystery of life is psychologically revealed through the fable of the Tower of Babylon, the tower which finally collapsed and resulted in the confusion of tongues, Now, we assume that these confusions of tongues represent the breaking up of language. But this is not actually true, because we understand that language is the key to the entire mystery that we are dealing with here. The division of tongues is music. Actually, the division of man's comprehensive power of words. A subject that has been restored to us after many centuries by the rising of the Superman. We know, for instance, that the confusion is not in the form of the words, but in their meaning. And that every word means to the individual only what he himself possesses of knowledge. Therefore, that through words we cannot actually communicate ideas, except that those who communicate must be on a common level. Otherwise, words, 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 and there is no profit in them. This experience we have all more or less gone through. Now, also in the opening chapters of Genesis, we come upon the Noah legend, the legend of Noah and his wonderful ark, and of the first destruction of the world, or the final passing away of the antediluvian creation. These are all psychological experiences within the human being himself. And in the theological systems of other nations, we find accounts which are parallel to those in Genesis. For instance, in the Chinese system, the first patriarch, his wife, their three sons, and their three daughters were all brought into a ship and carried over the oblivion, exactly as in the Jewish story. We have an almost identical account in India also, of an extraordinary antiquity, far older than anything that we have in the Palestine area. So that we know that we are dealing with principles. We know that we are dealing with power. We know also that we are dealing with archetypal forms that will return in the experience of the individual in each of the culture systems which he produces. In the Noah legend, we find, for example, the return or the retiring of the creation. We find the destruction of an old world and all that it stood for. We find the good man and his family saved by divine intervention. And that from this good man and his family, and from the clean and the unclean animals of the earth, a repopulation is taken form. So that Noah occupies the situation or position of a second Adam. And it is so listed in the ancient chronicles and in the ancient patterns of things. And in Hebrew also, we have Adam Kadmon, Adam of the Red Earth. We know that this Adam Kadmon is the archetypal man, the protagonist of Plato. That Adam represents the collective, and it is numerical power is identical with that of the Temple of Jerusalem. We know, therefore, that in a mysterious way, in the Old and New Testament, that the destiny of Adam is linked with that of the Messiah. For the first shall be last. And every one of these figures has in it. And has a complete and wonderful significance for us. In approaching these problems, we have been inclined, perhaps, to be a little influenced by veneration. We have not felt, perhaps, that the mysteries of heaven were for us. But therefore, it was our problem and our duty and our responsibility merely to believe and follow. This, however, is not the general attitude of even the old Jewish scholars. They firmly believed that the supreme power had given them faculties and abilities in order that they could use them. They did not feel that the divine being would have bestowed upon man a mind and the powers to think if he was not expected to use them. And that as the most natural inquiry of the mind is its relation to itself and to its origin and to its destiny, these questions must be proper to man or he could not fashion them within his own consciousness. Therefore, we come to a certain statement in the Old Testament, which I think is a good example of poor translation. There's a line in the Bible which says, "The mysteries of God are below the Him." Well, actually, we are not translating the words correct. The key words of it are that the sword is for the cottages. Now, that does not mean that the mysteries of God are below the Him. The sword is the body. Or the arcana, the total wisdom. It is the tremendous esoteric law, the complete structure of truth and understanding as it is conceivable to man. The word has two essential meanings. One, wisdom itself, and another, the circle or guardian of wisdom. The term is almost interchangeable. Well, the second part is, in other words, eternal wisdom or the great truth for the inevitable reality is our form of happiness. Now, the happiness or happiness represented the initiation of the ancient rites, those who were the advance complete, those who were privileged to enter into the wisdom, those who had purified and practiced the disciplines and had dedicated their lives to God. Therefore, our word is not the mystery of God for those appearing, but that the eternal wisdom is for those who are worthy, who are dedicated, who have made the necessary advancement and proficiency, and are in themselves enlightened and consecrated. Now that is quite a different meaning, because there is no part of the statement which implies fear. It implies entirely devotion, integrity, and attainment. Thus we have followed for a long time certain misconceptions which can and do affect our ability to understand the basic situation. Go on then, also, we have to pause for a moment now and consider the life of Moses because of his tremendous place in this entire context. The word Moses, we consider to apply primarily to a man, and we are looking somewhere in the story in this conflict between the Jewish scholars, the Christian scholars, the modern scientists, and the unbelievers, who are all more or less lost on these problems, we are looking for the true meaning of this. Now, we have no reason to doubt the historicity of Moses. In other words, we can by no means question or fail the probabilities of his life. But wherever we find a human and natural person involved in a religious mystery or incorporated ultimately into a scriptural writing, we find certain changes made in the physical or historical story of his life. We find that he is gradually transformed into an archetypal form. In other words, he must be more than a person. He must be the embodiment of the doctrine which he brings. So by degrees, step by step, his human attributes come to be generally ignored. Little by little, he emerges only in his archetypal form. They're no longer primarily interested in the normal daily occurrences of his life. They are not interested in his personal mistakes or his personal limitations. Gradually, he assumes the form of the universal embodiment of a doctrine. We know this occurred in the case of Moses. And we suspect, therefore, that we do not even know the name of the man with whom the story is now associated. Moses is a combination of letters, and is a very important combination of letters. It is almost too important to be a name. It is too fortuitous to be a name. Because all we have to do is follow a certain rule of the ancient Jewish gematria and rearrange these letters according to the formula. And we have, instead of Moses, Samach. And the moment we have Samach, we have the sun. So we know that Moses is the solar deity. We know, therefore, that he has been gradually associated with the sun cycle. In other words, that there is lurking, concealed somewhere in this story, what we know today as the astronomical mythos. We know that Moses is therefore also an embodiment of the symbolical principle for which the sun itself stands in nature. Because even your most primitive so-called sun worshiper did not and never did worship the physical body of the sun. He worshiped a principle. He worshiped the principle of life. He worshiped the principle of truth, which is inner life. He worshiped the principle of reality, which by its own existence dispels darkness. In other words, sun worship is light worship. Light worship is a symbolic statement of truth worship. It is the statement of man's concept of the victory of mental, spiritual, and spiritual life over ignorance, darkness, sin, and death.